he is destabilizing our security as a nation in a way that most didn't think possible.
Alaska's senators blast decisions expected from the Biden administration to block resource development in the Arctic. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for April 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lawmakers contemplate how to correct a correspondence school provision recently ruled unconstitutional.
Part of the interpretation of the ruling that just occurred is that the homeschooling correspondence laws are thrown out. In other words, programs are gone, potentially.
The Biden administration is making two big decisions this week that block resource extraction in Alaska, and the state's U.S. senators are fuming. The Alaska senators and a flock of their Republican colleagues held a press conference today claiming that President Biden is boosting the mineral-rich countries like Russia and Venezuela while driving down American industry. Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke of it in global terms.
He is destabilizing our security as a nation in a way that most didn't think possible in such a short time period.
The decisions are expected to be announced Friday, but national news outlets have already spilled the beans. As the New York Times reported, the administration intends not to allow a road in northwest Alaska that's crucial to the development of mining in the Ambler area. And as Bloomberg reported, the administration will adopt a rule to fortify environmental protections on sensitive areas of the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska on the North Slope. Both Ambler and the NPRA have massive tracts of undeveloped land that are important to migrating birds, wildlife, and subsistence harvests. Environmental groups and indigenous opponents of drilling and mining are preparing their responses to celebrate the expected news, but the GOP senators are not waiting for the official announcements. Murkowski says shutting down oil and mineral extraction in the U.S. will just drive the business overseas.
We'd rather take it from Iran, from Russia, and all the other places where they really don't care about us, and they love the fact that we're being crippled by our own administration.
Senator Dan Sullivan organized the Senate press conference. He says he wants to get the word out because he thinks American voters won't tolerate the assaults on Alaska mining and drilling.
The most important thing we can do is retake the Senate, retake the White House. That's going to be the ultimate revenge here.
Sullivan says Congress could pass a resolution to overturn the environmental rule in the National Petroleum Reserve. President Biden would certainly veto that resolution, but Sullivan says if the rule is delayed a bit, the decision could be left to the next president if Donald Trump wins the November election. Governor Mike Dunleavy is warning that a Superior Court decision invalidating key parts of the state's homeschool program could have far-reaching impacts. But as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, others say it's not so clear.
In a 17th-floor conference room with a dominating view of downtown Anchorage, Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor laid out what he sees as the impact of a recent court ruling that threw out two laws underpinning the state's homeschool system.
In light of the vague, broad nature of the court's reasoning, it is very difficult to determine what type of program would actually be permitted under this decision, where, in fact, it draws into question spending that has taken place in public schools for decades.
One of the laws Anchorage Superior Court Judge Adolph Zeman found unconstitutional creates the framework for homeschool curriculum, so-called individual learning plans. The other statute provides cash payments known as allotments to homeschool parents, who can use them for things like textbooks and materials. Plaintiffs told the judge that parents were using their allotments on private school classes. They argued that's a violation of the Alaska Constitution, which forbids using public money, quote, for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. Taylor and Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy say they're planning to appeal the ruling on an expedited basis to the Alaska Supreme Court. And Dunleavy says the ruling, if it stands, will have far-reaching consequences.
Part of the interpretation of the ruling that just occurred is that the homeschooling correspondence laws are thrown out. In other words, programs are gone, potentially.
But are they?
That is 1,000,000% false, and here's why.
Scott Kendall is an attorney representing the four plaintiffs who challenged the correspondence school allotment program after noting an uptick in private schools advertising that parents could pay tuition with state-funded allotments. He says he was frustrated watching the governor's news conference.
They kept repeating, the judge said, correspondence schools are unconstitutional. We can't have this anymore. And that is fundamentally incorrect. The judge said, you have constructed the correspondence school statute in a way that's blatantly unconstitutional. I can't fix it. I'm not a legislator. I'm the court. The legislature can fix it.
And that's basically what the judge said in the final words of his ruling. Essentially, if the legislature thinks correspondence school allotments should exist, it should write a law that creates them without violating the Constitution. Senator Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat who chairs the Senate Education Committee, says correspondence schools existed before the 2014 law that Judge Zeman's ruling invalidates.
The rest of the authorizing regulation continues to exist even without those particular statutes. There may need to be some propagation of emergency regulation, or there may need to be some tweaks to some of our regulation, but we still have the ability to continue to operate correspondence programs for our homeschool parents.
Dunleavy, on the other hand, argues a favorable court decision or a constitutional amendment is necessary to make sure the correspondence program continues. The House Judiciary Committee, chaired by Republican Representative Sarah Vance of Homer, came out with its own proposed solution, a constitutional amendment that would remove the language about private and religious schools. The measure would need a two-thirds majority in both houses to advance to a public vote, though it's not clear that even a simple majority of the House would support it, and Senate leaders say they don't support spending on private or religious school classes. The judge's decision is likely to be put on hold at least through the end of June, and perhaps longer. An appeal could take months or years to resolve. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Eric Stone.
NOAA Fisheries announced today it will not be implementing new limits on Chinook salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. The national organization that helps manage federal fisheries in Alaska was responding to a January petition from Western Alaska communities asking for a total ban on Chinook bycatch in the large trawl fishery. NOAA regulators said in the statement that the petition did not meet criteria necessary for emergency action. Subsistence harvests and traditional practices are in jeopardy in many Western Alaska communities as Chinook salmon returns remain critically low in the region. Most scientists point to climate change and warming oceans as the main culprit, but the pollock fishery is also under scrutiny for the substantial number of salmon incidentally caught in trawl nets while targeting pollock. The pollock fishery currently has a cap on Chinook bycatch, but those asking for stricter limits say the restrictions don't go far enough. Nearly 100 tribes and communities in Western Alaska, including the Association of Village Council Presidents, signed the emergency petition on January 17th. NOAA Fisheries said restricting all Chinook bycatch would effectively close the pollock fishery, which is the largest in the nation, as well as one of the most lucrative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state plans to allow tribal police to enforce some laws in part of the Mat-Su.
They are planning to use this as sort of a template, if you will, for future applications.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A unique policing agreement in a part of the Matanuska Susitna Borough will allow tribal police to enforce some state laws. The idea is that with state authorization, the Chickaloon Native Village's tribal police will fill a policing gap in the Sutton area, east of Palmer, in a part of the borough that often does not have a meaningful Alaska State Trooper presence. As the Anchorage Daily News reports, that's because only 5 troopers are typically on patrol in all of the Mat-Su, an area the size of West Virginia, and they tend to focus on the more populated areas adjacent to Palmer and Wasilla. ADN reporter Amy Bouchatz was at a meeting in Sutton last week to brief the community about the proposed agreement, and Bouchatz says it would only apply to a specific area and for specific laws.
Yeah, so the agreement will let Chickaloon's police force enforce law in this 68-square-mile region that's off the Glen Highway and is northwest of what you might think of as Sutton, plus those village properties that are in actual Sutton. It would allow them to police misdemeanors. It would allow them to police felony drug and misdemeanor drug crimes, and it would allow them to police sex trafficking, either misdemeanor or felony. So I think it's important to note that the other side of this, that the reason that Chickaloon says this is important, Chickaloon wants to have the ability to police those crimes against their citizens when they are committed by a non-Alaska Native citizen.
So if you lived in Palmer or Wasilla or Fairbanks, I mean, a number of different cities, there's a tax base there. They've got their own police force. They pay for that police force with the tax base. And I know that's a kind of a simple version of that because there's money that comes from other places too. But How does this work? I mean, who actually pays for this?
So one of the reasons the Department of Public Safety says that they are interested in doing this is because of that funding. There is a variety of high-dollar grants available to tribal police forces right now through federal programs that are equipping these tribal police forces with officers and training and equipment, actual physical equipment that you need to do policing, and really setting them up to be able to fill this need. And so the Department of Public Safety is looking at this and saying, these police forces have the funding and they have the training to meet our standards that we require for people who are having partnerships like this with us. So we should use them because they are already equipped and funded by somebody outside of the state, by the federal government.
Gotcha. And I mean, as far as the Chickaloon police in this agreement, what are they doing to, I guess, adjust to maybe an extra workload? Are they adding officers and equipment like that?
Yeah, so they have received about $4.3 million in federal grants, and that's gone towards that police training I was talking about, and equipment and other tribal justice programs. They have three officers that they have equipped and that they will be, you know, submitting to the state to participate in this program. And I should mention that the state has an agreement, so it's like a memorandum of understanding with the tribal police force, but it is individual officers who are commissioned under this special agreement to be that extension of state law. So Chickaloon has three officers for this right now. They're planning to add a fourth, you know, and as far as like funding for that, it's all from the federal government.
Back to this meeting last week, how did that go? It sounded like it was like 3 hours long. People were giving public testimony and it was maybe a lot of different points of view on that. But what did you hear from people there?
Yeah, so this meeting was held in the Sutton Elementary School. It was certainly well attended, and it was actually a fairly calm meeting. People asked very thoughtful questions. They were each given an opportunity by the meeting organizer, which was representatives from Sutton's Community Council, to ask a question and a follow-up question. Sometimes that went into two follow-up questions, as meetings are wont to do sometimes. They had to do with, like, how is this set up? What are the practical implications for this? You know, what does this look like from a I'm a citizen here and I'll be interacting with these police officers perspective? And then there were also concerns. You know, the Department of Public Safety made sure to tell everybody that the Chickaloon police would not be empowered under this agreement to do any traffic stops, which is a hot button topic there.
In terms of how the state's looking at this, how the Department of Public Safety is looking at this, there was something in your story kind of along the lines of like, you could expect more of this in the future, right?
The Department of Public Safety expects more tribal police forces to be applying to them for similar memorandums of understanding and special commissions for officers because they are receiving this federal funding for police training and equipment and tribal justice programs. And so they are planning to use this as sort of a template, if you will, for future applications so that they have already been through how to decide what this looks like and what parameters the tribe has and those sorts of things. And so, yes, they expect more of these applications in the future and that this is really just the start.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Amy Bouchatz. You can find her full story about a proposed policing agreement between the state and Chickaloon Native Village at ADN.com. The Anchorage School District is preparing to welcome 2,000 sixth graders into seven middle schools. The district decided to make all middle schools 6th through 8th grade for the next school year. As Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky reports, principals and district administrators are busy figuring out how it will all work next fall.
Roemig Middle School principal Carrie Sumner points to a pair of floor plans in her office, showing where classrooms will be next year.
So we're utilizing, as you can see, all classroom space, all space period.
Nearly the entire school is being reorganized. Just 8 teachers will keep their same classroom next fall. The rest will move elsewhere in the building or to one of 4 new portable classrooms or relocatables, as the district calls them. Sumner says she's excited about the change. She says students will benefit socially and academically by spending an extra year in middle school.
2 years is a quick stopover. the opportunity to have them for 3 years and really get to know them well, support them well, I think is going to be a huge benefit.
But there's still a lot to do. Sumner has to hire 22 new teachers for the nearly 400 sixth graders that will attend ROMIG next year. She's interviewed over 100 candidates and still has a half dozen positions to fill.
It is a lot of change. We will do it, but it is a lot of change. I hear more about start time concerns than I do about sixth grade moving to middle school.
Sixth graders already attend Begich, Clark, and Mirror Lake middle schools. The other seven Anchorage middle schools will add them next fall. Moving sixth graders out of elementary schools and into middle schools could save the district some money in the long term, but middle school education director Joe Zawadny says the change is more about academic impacts than budget cuts.
The real purpose for moving sixth graders to middle school is to provide equity across the district. We already have three schools where sixth graders get to enjoy certain electives and extracurricular opportunities that sixth graders at other schools don't, right? And so really it was bringing the whole district in line with opportunities for students more than it was a way to save money.
Zawadny says that the district began talking about the idea before the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, weekly meetings of middle school principals in the district have focused on preparing for the upcoming change. Administrators and principals have spent the last 2 years getting ready, and Zawadny says the two biggest concerns are space and staffing.
And in some situations like ROMIG, we know that at least for the next few years, we're going to have more students than the school can provide space for, and so we're actually adding four relocatables to that school.
To make enough space for 2,000 sixth graders, the district will relocate 9 portable classrooms to 4 schools. ROMIG Middle School will become the largest middle school in the district with over 1,100 students.
We went out, we toured every school several times to make sure not only do they have the space they need for the projected enrollment, but that they have the technology they need, right? The educational technology, display tech, that they're going to have enough furniture, enough classrooms.
ROMIG principal Carrie Sumner graduated from the Anchorage School District and has spent 2 decades working as an educator in Alaska. Even with 2 years of prep, she's still not sure they've thought of everything.
We're trying to think of everything, but we're human beings. It's a huge lift to move an entire, you think of it being a class, like my sixth grade class is moving, but it's hundreds and thousands of kids. So it's quite a logistical matrix.
But Sumner is confident that middle schools will be able to quickly fix any issues that pop up and provide a smooth transition for sixth graders next fall. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
A new nonprofit has been established in Craig aimed at helping young people in the Southeast Alaska community reclaim Haida language and culture. HEAL, which stands for Haida Ethnology and Advancing Language, announced its formation last month with the mission of empowering and nurturing the local Haida community and heritage. Rob Yates is a founding board member of HEAL and a Haida language teacher.
We are learning our indigenous languages.
Yates is certified with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's Our Language Pathway Program and also teaches through the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida. He considers himself somewhere between intermediate and advanced, but not fluent.
It's so important to speak the language on the land because our ancestors spoke it on the land and our ancestors came to hear us. They also help us and guide us. So it's really important to bring it back and normalize it. We don't want it thought of as a foreign language because it's not foreign. It comes from here.
The organization plans to offer workshops, classes, and resources to Haida community members and their families. Yates said that the land that Craig occupies used to house 3 Haida villages. The last fluent elder in Craig passed away in 1983.
This type of nonprofit here in Craig, and we're desperately low on Haida language teachers and speakers, and we want to change that. We want to normalize the language, and we need to raise more speakers, but even more importantly, more teachers. If we don't raise up more teachers, then we're going to be in a serious amount of hurt as far as saving the language goes.
Yates says the organization is grassroots and the goal right now is to raise community support as well as find fun and engaging ways to get people interested in the language. HEAL hopes to hold its first workshop on the first Saturday of June at the Craig Tribal Hall. It's been over a decade since a set of 20,000-year-old fossilized human footprints was found in a dry lake bed in New Mexico. Those footprints have sent shockwaves through the scientific community, shockwaves that have reverberated all the way up to Alaska. A recent paper published in the journal Nature uses cave remains and animal fossils to construct a chronology of when people were inhabiting the shores of Southeast Alaska by pinpointing when they weren't. As KRBD's Jack Darrell reports, it's just one piece of a much bigger puzzle.
The recent article published in Nature caught Nick Schmuck's attention. He's an archaeologist with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. He says how and when people showed up in Alaska and the Americas is a surprisingly heated debate in the scientific community that may never be settled. Currently, the most commonly held belief is in coastal migration theory. Remember the Bering Land Bridge? That theory basically goes that after the last ice age, people crossed a stretch of land between Russia and Alaska in pursuit of food. The idea that people arrived either by land or waterways from Asia down along the coast of Alaska and into the rest of the Americas.
If these people coming into the Americas, doesn't matter how far back we go, they're just as capable as you and I. So of course they can figure out how to use boats. They're no strangers to rivers and things like that. So why not the coast?
But there are other theories about the hows and whens, especially the whens. The recent article published in Nature called New Age Constraints for Human Entry into the Americas on the North Pacific Coast attempts to tighten the parameters of the debate a little bit. The paper looks at gaps in dates of animal fossils and archaeological sites, including 18 caves and sites in Southeast Alaska. During the iciest part of the last ice age, a massive ice sheet advanced across the western part of the continent over Prince of Wales Island, the largest island southeast. Think of it like a gate that closed for over 1,000 years. When that gate froze shut, what's called the glacial maximum, was about 18,000 years ago. So the commonly held belief is that people showed up after that, as the glaciers melted from the outside in, revealing land and food to eat. And Schmuck says it isn't just the fossil record that supports this post-glacial theory. It's also the spoken record of the descendants of these first people.
There are stories that sound, histories that sound like people coming to an early post-glacial Southeast Alaska. You know, they talk about coming to a land that's just a, you know, a narrow strip of land between the ice and the sea. Like, holy cow, that's what Southeast Alaska would have been. You know, before the trees come in.
Kahani Rosita Wuerl is a descendant of these first people. She's a Tlingit anthropologist and president of the Sealaska Heritage Institute.
The important things to remember is that we know we have been here for at least 11,000, 12,000 years. We know that from the DNA science, you know. And to me, I always say it affirms our oral traditions that say we've been here since time immemorial.
If the dates are correct, the New Mexico footprints are much older than artifacts found in Southeast. That means the footprints were from someone who was here before the glaciers sealed the land shut. In turn, that means that either the humans that left those footprints didn't cross the Bering Land Bridge at all, that there's a southern route somehow, or people were here much earlier than Western scientists thought. Wuerl says, of course there were other routes into the Americas.
So there had to be another route.
Currently, the earliest sign of life in Southeast Alaska is Shukaka, a human skeleton and set of tools from about 12,000 years ago in a cave on Prince of Wales Island. It's possible archaeologists just haven't found older evidence yet because of the challenges of searching in a forest-covered region. For Southeast Alaska, a lot of the oldest evidence of humans is probably either at the top of a mountain or at the bottom of the ocean, which is where Kelly Monteleone comes in.
There's this huge, vast area that we haven't explored yet. And so there's so much we can find.
Monteleone is an underwater archaeologist with Sealaska Heritage Institute.
I see myself as having the resources to help answer the questions of the indigenous people of Southeast Alaska. So I have the skills as an underwater archaeologist to go out and look in areas to help them learn about their past.
As Wuerl, Schmuck, and Monteleone all point out, the indigenous peoples along the Northwest coast are strikingly diverse. There are so many languages and cultures in such a condensed area, and the languages are so isolatedly different from each other that it seems like people would have had to have been here a lot longer than other parts of the Americas.
Time immemorial, from the beginning of time, Yes, 12,000 years ago, 16, 20,000 years ago. Those are all the beginning of time.
And while the rest of the world chases after New Mexico's footprints, Monteleone says that understanding the history of the people of the Northwest Coast is an archaeological field of study that's still in its infancy. Here on the Northwest Coast, in Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
And finally tonight, a correction to a story last night that incorrectly stated the number to call for people in imminent danger from a wildlife encounter. Anyone in imminent danger of any kind can call 911. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Eric Stone, and Theo Greenlee in Anchorage, and Jack Darrell in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.